Hello, and thank you for finding Living with Dying, the podcast where we talk all about death and dying and matters to do with that. If you've been listening for some time now, you'll know that we've covered all kinds of different scenarios around death and dying. We've talked to a lot of people about their loss and their grief, but also to some people who have managed to get on with their lives after a big loss and a big tragedy. And today I'm talking to someone who epitomises all of that, Carolyn Mailing, who's written an amazing book called The Future is Rosy. And Carolyn, lovely to meet you. I think the sensible place to start would be to ask, who is Rosie?
So it's lovely to be here as well. Thank you very much for inviting me. Rosie was my daughter, my younger daughter, and she very tragically died when she was 11 years old. She'd never been ill in her life, and all of a sudden she became ill. So it sort of hit us like a ton of bricks out of the blue. So Rosie basically was a young performer. She was a talented little girl. We run Red Roof School for the Performing Arts in Maidenhead, and she was a pupil at our school. And she would sing and dance and write shows, and she was very prolific, actually, and wrote a musical as well. When she was 10, she wrote a musical with her sister Ellie and a couple of friends. It wasn't that unusual because they just kept on writing musicals anyway, but they wrote a musical called Forever and a Day. And this was particularly to raise money for the daughter of a friend of mine who was a little disabled girl, and they wanted to raise money for a wheelchair for her. So they put on this rather amazing show. It was a full-length musical, and Rosie just stood up at the end of the show completely unscripted and gave a very long speech about raising the money and thanking everybody. And just, she was just like that, and she was only 10 at the time. She was just very kind of like wise and mature beyond her years, really.
So what went wrong?
So it was just after that she was doing panto. She was rehearsing for pantomime, actually, and she suddenly became unwell. So we didn't think too much of it. We just, you know, she was coughing, and we thought, okay, she's got a chest infection. Let's get her to the GP. So she went through sort of various courses of antibiotics and stuff, and nothing worked. And gradually it took hold, this awful cough, and she wasn't able to breathe properly. And then we had to actually take her off the panto, so she was absolutely gutted because it was just her life, all this performing thing. So she spent Christmas basically in bed that Christmas instead of being performing with her friends and so on. And I was actually thinking about this little thing last night because someone was asking me, but on Christmas Eve she was really unwell, and I went up to her bedroom and she said, you know, Mummy, I'm going to die of this. And I said, stop being a drama queen, because, you know, I just thought she had a really bad chest infection at the time. And she went, I am going to die of this. Anyway, so Christmas passed, and then we got to the new year, and she wasn't getting any better. So eventually the GP referred her to a specialist, and she went to see a consultant. And the consultant said, oh, it's pneumonia, we'll put this right. So there was more treatment, and she was on inhalers and all sorts of things which weren't working. And she was gradually getting worse and worse, and she wasn't able to go back to school. And then I was talking to a friend of mine whose son's a GP, and she said, well, my son just said, why are they not asking for this scan, that scan, this, that and the other? And so I went back to the consultant and I said, why have you not done this? And she said, you can't go ordering scans willy-nilly. And I said, please just do them, because I just had this horrible feeling at that time that something was really wrong. Anyway, so she said, all right. So anyway, so she underwent these tests. 20 minutes after the scan results came back on the same day, this consultant came in, and she was really looking very worried. And she said, right, we've got to ambulance her up to John Radcliffe in Oxford. We found pulmonary embolism on the arteries going into her lungs. And that's why she can't breathe. We've got to get her up there fast. So we went in this ambulance, and it was just like being thrust into this kind of sudden kind of world of medication and doctors and hospitals and people running around. And she went straight into intensive care. Although I didn't think she was that ill to warrant that, but she went into intensive care, and spent a few days in there. The consultants couldn't find out what was the matter at all. And then she was moved up onto the ward, onto the children's ward. Now, That was before the new children's hospital was built. It was called Ward 4B, and it was full of children with cancer and with no hair, and it was really a difficult place to be. And Rosie had these long flowing brown locks, and she was looking at all these children with their hair falling out, and anyway, she was in there for quite some time, and she exhausted all the toys in the playroom. There was nothing for her to do. She was fed up. She wanted to go back to school. And then one day in the playroom, she said to the play specialist, she said, "When I'm better, I'm going to raise money for the children in this hospital, so they haven't got to be as bored as I am ever. And I'm going to raise money by doing shows." So time went on. She underwent quite a few big operations, because they still couldn't find out what was going on, so they needed to open her up and have a look. And there was one day when they were doing quite a serious operation. They had to cut her from her neck down to her tummy, and then they said they had to stop her heart, and they told her that in front of her, and she said, "What, so you're going to kill me and then bring me back to life? Oh, right, okay." She was really stressed out, and I was a mess. So my older daughter Ellie was at home. She was 14 at the time, with my now ex-husband, and she was at home, and he was looking after her. So I was on my own at the hospital a lot of the time. He would bring her up and down and stuff, and bring my mum up to visit and so on. But mainly it was me there, and I was a complete mess, and I felt I didn't have anyone to talk to. And one day I actually locked myself in the toilet. It was just before she had this a big operation, another one I think it was. And the nurse came and knocked on the door, and she said, "Are you all right?" And I went, yeah, I'm fine." And she said, "Can you come out?" And I said, "No, I'm fine, honestly. You know, because there was nobody to support the parents, and the nurses were all rushed off their feet looking after the kids. And I didn't want to bother anybody. But there were a whole load of parents like me. Everybody was stressed out on that ward. And I thought, God, there is just like nothing there for parents. Anyway, so eventually after, it was around about 6 months-ish. So she came out of hospital around about the end of April and went home. She came home. She really wasn't very well. She'd lost loads of weight. And she wanted to, all she wanted to do was go back to school and get back to normal. And she had all her books by the door and everything. And then it was Monday, May the 6th, engraved in my head forever. And she woke up in the morning and she said, "Mummy, I'm going to go down and play on the computer." I said, "Okay." And then I heard her cough. And then she suddenly said, "Mummy, I'm coughing up blood." And then we rushed downstairs, me and David. It was literally just, it was horrendous. And I said, "Right, we've got to get her back to hospital really fast." Fortunately, my other daughter was staying overnight with a friend the night before, so she wasn't there. And we thought, well, if we call an ambulance, they'll just take her back to a different hospital. They won't take her straight up to John Radcliffe. So I said, "Put her in the back of the car." So we put her in the back of the car, and we sped up the M40. And all the time she was getting worse, and she couldn't breathe. And when we got her there, it was Bank Holiday Monday, so there was like a skeleton staff. And I rushed her up to 4B, and all the staff were going, "Oh my God, oh my God," right? And they were bleeping all these emergency numbers and stuff. And then they rushed her down to intensive care, and then she had a heart attack. She had a cardiac arrest, and her consultant, Anne Thompson, marvellous woman, she'd been called. She was actually at home doing her garden, and she came rushing in. And I just saw her going past the corridor, and she had her gardening togs on and stuff. And she rushed past, she didn't even say hello. And then all I heard was all this noise coming from intensive care, and they were trying to bring her back to life. So we sat there, and then they said, "Right, we brought her round. She's on life support." And then we spent days and days with her on the life support machine. And then gradually the hope just... We just lost hope, and they said, right, one day they said, "She's in a vegetative state, she's brain dead, we're going to have to turn the machines off." So it wasn't a decision that I had to make personally. They just said, "This is what it is." And then Anne Thompson had actually said to me, "You know, there are things that are worse than death." She actually came and said, "You know, there are things that are worse than death, and that is, you know, would you like to see your child in a vegetative state for the, you know, having to live like..." And I said, I couldn't stand that, because Rosie was so full of life. And prior to, in fact, just when she came, she'd come home a few weeks earlier, and she was on her swing, and she was swinging really high. And I was saying, Rosie, don't swing so high. Just go slower. Please go slower. Because I was really worried about her anyway, because she was so thin and weak. And she was going, Mummy, I don't want to be limited. Don't limit my life. I'm not going to be limited in any way. And so that was just kind of ringing in my ears. And I went, yeah, it's, you know, we have to do what we have to do. So they turned the machine off, and I held her for a few hours, and it took a while. And we just kind of lay in bed with her. And they took all the wires out and all this stuff. And then she passed away. And then and then we went, well, what do we do? So they sent us down this corridor to a bereavement office. And there was a bereavement officer in there, and she gave us a pile of papers. She gave us a cup of tea, and she gave us a pile of papers saying how to bury your child, what to do, you know, how to register the death and stuff. And then sent us off down the motorway. And we went, well, now what? You know, literally our whole world had fallen apart. It was just the worst moment of my life, of our lives. And came back down the motorway. We stayed at my mum's house actually that night, because we couldn't bear the thought of going back to a house where Rosie wasn't. And then the day after, David, my ex-husband, had a heart attack from the stress of it all. So he spent 2 weeks in hospital in London, and came out the day before the funeral. So we had to make all the funeral arrangements without him. And then we had the funeral. And in the afternoon of her funeral, we had a sort of celebration of her life. So we had a cremation in the morning. It was horrendous. And then we had a celebration of her life, and we invited all her little friends to come and read poems or do whatever in our theatre. We had a theatre in Ascot at the time. And I was just lost. I just, you know, I was just in a complete, in a haze. I just kind of, I don't know, I was on automatic, I suppose. I don't know what I was doing. And then in the afternoon, I was talking to somebody in the foyer after the celebration. And I said, you know, I've got to do something so that I can create a legacy where Rosie's never, ever going to be forgotten, because her little life can't have been just for nothing. And then I looked outside the theatre, and there's this massive double rainbow over the theatre. Now, Rosie had always been like really colourful and always wore really bright colours. And she always wore stripy tights, and, you know, she had rainbow coloured T-shirts. And I went, that's it. She's out there, and she's telling me, it's Rosie's Rainbow. You've got to do something, Mummy. It's Rosie's Rainbow Fund. So that was the beginning of how we set up the charity. So Rosie's Rainbow Fund, because Rosie was very musical, we were thinking for a while, what can we do? So we thought, okay, music therapy. We'd spoken to the play specialists up there who we'd got to know really well over the last few months, and they said, well, how about either either music therapy or art therapy? And I said, it's got to be music, because Rosie wrote musicals. So we went ahead and I found a music therapist, and that was the little beginning of it all. So we implemented a music therapist at John Radcliffe, and it grew. So now we've got three music therapists. We've got one at John Radcliffe, one at Royal Barks at Reading, and one at Stoke Mandeville, because there's a lot of children with spinal injuries there who are there a lot for a long time. And so we do that. And then I thought, right, so we've also got to look after the parents, because I don't want any parents feeling like unsupported as I was. So we now have a wonderful lady who does parent support at John Radcliffe. And she gets the parents away from the bed, and she can give them an aromatherapy massage, and they can offload, and she's like the listening ear, like the normal person among all these medications and medical people and all that sort of hospital stuff. So for the children, it's a moment in their day with music therapy that they can actually forget about being controlled, and they can have control over their music. And for the parents, they have their chance to offload. And then there was no bereavement support. So for me and David, there was literally nothing. So we'd spent weeks and weeks like not knowing what to do, who to talk to. We didn't feel we could speak to people because no one understood. And then an amazing lady just turned up on my doorstep, and she was called Jenny Thomas. she'd found out about us via a friend of a friend, and she turned up and she went, "I'm Jenny Thomas, and I look after bereaved parents, and I'm here to help you." And it was like a lifeline. It was absolutely amazing, and from that moment I felt supported. And then she kind of looked after me. It was interesting because David didn't want any sort of counselling, anything. I think men just are different. I don't know if all men are different, but that one certainly was.
Oh, what stage are we talking about now? We're talking about some time after Rosie died, aren't we?
A few weeks. Yeah, and in between that few weeks, I'd gone off to... I'd actually rung a helpline on one night. There was one night I just thought, I can't cope with this. And I found this helpline, which was called Compassionate Friends. And it was full of... It was all run by bereaved parents, for parents who'd lost children. And I thought, okay, I'm going to ring their helpline because I can't get through the night. And they kind of put me in touch with people. I joined this forum, which actually was really useful. And I met some amazing people, other mums, through that. But they also directed me to a support meeting thing. And I went to this support meeting. I don't think they were running it, but it was somewhere. And I went to this meeting, and there were eight people sitting around this table in this quite dark room, and they were all sitting there with their heads in their hands, like rocking. And I was going, like, how long ago did your child die? And they went, 8 years, 12 years, gosh, 15 years, you know. And I thought, not going to do this. I thought Rosie would be just appalled if I turned into, you know, if I didn't cope better than that. So I made a decision on that day that I wasn't going to do that. And I was going to live life as fully as I can, so that when I get there, I can tell her all about it. Yeah, so that's kind of what I did, really. And I went on being connected with these amazing ladies on the forum, and we're still in touch now. Like, it's 20 years ago, and you know, you just don't ever you do move on, but you don't move on. You know, you just don't forget. It's just different. You learn to live differently.
I've heard a lot of people say what you've just said about needing to find people who understand your particular circumstances. Mm. Somebody who's been bereaved in a different way can't put themselves in your shoes, can they? So you managed to find what you needed in terms of people around you.
I did, and then gradually people were finding me as well in the local area, who I became so friendly with. And I found it was enormously helpful for me to listen to them, because I was like, to them, I was like the old girl. And I was like, I'd kind of got all the experience, and you know, I knew what to do, but I didn't, obviously. But they, you know, because they were like new to it, and I was gradually finding these people, or they were finding me, and I found it was enormously helpful to lessen my pain by listening to and trying to help other people. It really did help for some reason.
So what I don't quite understand is, what actually did Rosie die of?
So they eventually diagnosed that she had vasculitis, which is an autoimmune disease which affects the blood vessels, which is why her arteries were affected. But it kind of went on to affect many other parts of her body as well. But it was mainly her lungs and her arteries and her heart and so on. But they didn't think that she was going to die of it.
Can you describe a bit more about what that pain was actually like? I mean, you've spoken so eloquently about the whole story of Rosie's tragic death, but the worst times, the really black times, can you describe what that felt like?
It was like, so in the early part, it was like I was scared to go to sleep. I was scared to wake up, because I knew that when I woke up, it would just literally, it was like a tidal wave. It was just... So I'd sleep for a few hours and then wake up, and then for a moment, for like a split second, you'd kind of forget that anything's happened, and then it literally comes at you like a tsunami, and it's like, it feels like you're drowning. I can only describe it like that. And the pain was like so, I felt like, I think I've said in my book actually, it's like having cold bones, because I just felt like freezing cold a lot of the time. Yeah, I felt like my bones were cold and I just couldn't get warm, and I just wanted to, I wanted someone to hold me, but I didn't want anyone to hold me, because I only wanted Rosie to hold me. That was all I wanted. And David handled it completely differently, didn't want to talk about it, didn't want to address my pain, because his pain was just too much, I guess. So he actually went off, he found a personal trainer and went off to the gym and worked out and did all that, and didn't want to discuss at all. So in my darkest times, when I literally felt I couldn't cope, he would go, don't talk to me about it, don't, I just can't. And he'd just literally walk off. And I'd just be sitting, like, rocking in a corner. It was just, like, horrendous. I found some great friends, not bereaved friends, but that had a bunch of really good friends who hadn't been particularly that friendly before. And they kind of, they really just kind of saved me, really. They'd just come round and play music. They're mostly musicians and singers and so on. There was a chap called Michael, South African guy, who was a composer, and he was actually working for us at Red Roofs. We became extremely close because he had really, like, powerful spiritual beliefs about afterlife and about what comes after, and it just kind of gave me hope. And he used to get messages, and I kind of clung on to that. And we used to have these kind of musical soirees. So there was Michael and his partner Martin, and then a couple of other friends, a few other friends, and we'd all just kind of sit around in my house playing the piano and singing, and it just really helped me at that particular time for some reason.
And you also obviously channeled a lot of your grief into all this wonderful work with the charities that you've been doing, and that must be very satisfying, because you're doing it not just for yourself to help get over your loss, but you're doing it for Rosie, aren't you?
Yeah, I feel like I am. Yeah, and in fact, I was talking to Jenny Thomas a couple of weeks ago. She said, you know, what you're actually doing is you're still parenting. It's your way of still parenting Rosie. And she's an amazing bereavement expert. And she said it's your way of continuing to be her mum. And I feel like that's absolutely true. But I feel like she channels through me anyway. I feel her, like, really close a lot of the time. And I feel like what I'm doing with the charity is her doing. So I just say, right, what do I do now, Rosie? And then she kind of gives me all the ideas. So, yeah.
And it must be very comforting to see it all grow and to see the good that you're doing. I mean, you go back and look, do you, and see how they're getting on it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I go up every now and again, and I watch their sessions, I watch the music. And honestly, it's just like the parents come to me and they go, you know, it's just amazing. It's just such a ray of sunshine in their day, or rainbow, I should say, in their day of not very nice stuff happening to them. And actually, it's so immensely helpful. And they all look out for Andy. He's called Andy, our current music therapist at Oxford, and they call him Andy the Music Man. And he arrives with his box of instruments, and it's just brilliant, yeah. And he not only gives them a good time, but he can also calm them down before they have a serious op, or motivate them when they won't get out of bed. And, you know, and there are also a lot of children who are non-verbal, so it's a very powerful way through music of reaching them. So I find it immensely useful for me to know that Rosie's life was for something. You know, it actually goes on, and it goes on, and she goes on living through her work.
So if I were to sum up what you've been saying about how you've coped with such an enormous tragedy, and it is the worst thing that anybody can possibly imagine, isn't it, losing a child?
Yeah.
But it seems that you're saying you found help from talking. You had some really good help from certain people,
yeah.
People who understood a bit about what you were going through.
I think women particularly, they like to talk and talk and tell and tell and tell. I must have told my story about a million times, and I still find it useful to be able to just talk like I'm talking to you. It's not kind of like going back into that dark place, but it just helps me to, I don't know, for some reason, stay sane. You know, I still have bad days, but, you know. I always know now that I can dig myself out of that by doing something positive.
But this isn't the end of the story of your losses, is it? Because you went on to have more.
Yeah, so, there was a lot that happened in between. So after Rosie died, I had this compulsion to have another baby, and went through a five-year IVF journey, which culminated eventually when I was 54 in the birth of my son Dominic, who is now nearly 16, 6 foot one. And he's amazing. So Rosie died in 2003, so 2005 we sort of got underway. And my sister Sam offered her eggs because the doctor had said to me, you can do this, you can do IVF, but not with your own eggs, because I was 48 at that time. And I went, okay. And then Sam really amazingly said, right, you can have my eggs, because she was a bit younger than me. So we went through a lot of counselling and stuff. But sadly, that didn't work. So that felt like loss. And then I turned 50, so I thought that was it. I'd lost everything, but I just had this... I kept on with this knowing that I was going to have another baby at some point. I don't know if I was mad or I was getting messages from up there from, you know, but I just kept on. And David was going, you know, we really should stop because actually it's not going to work. And I said, look, I can't stop. And then everyone was going, but you're 50. And I'm going, yeah. And then a very dear friend of mine, she said, I've found somebody who can do this for you in Harley Street. Go and see them. So I went to see this clinic, and they said, yeah, we can do it for you, but we've got a 3-year waiting list. And I was kind of working it out and thinking, oh, I think I'll be like this. So they said, but you know, if you don't want to wait 3 years, then you can go to our sister hospital in Cyprus, and they can do it sort of pretty much straight away. And I went, okay, we'll do that then. So came back and relayed this news to David. And he went, oh my God, you know, it's madness, but okay, if that's really what you want, okay. So we had all the treatment in London, and then they said, right, when we press the button, you need to go out to Cyprus, Limassol, you know, 12 hours notice. And that's literally what happened. They rang us up and they said, right, we need you out tomorrow morning for the embryo transfer. So it was David's sperm. He was the sperm donor, but we had to get an egg donor who was a veterinary surgeon from Moldova. So we had this embryo out there, and we had to whiz out there. When we arrived in Cyprus, it was Cyprus Easter, and there were eggs everywhere. There was these like floor to ceiling eggs, big Easter eggs. And I was going, it's a sign, David, it's a sign. And he was going, that's so bloody stupid. And anyway, so we went, stayed in this hotel, and then we'd made this appointment to go and see this obstetrician the next morning. And there were eggs all down the dual carriageway, and I was going, it's going to be good, it's going to be good. Anyway, so we got to this clinic, and the obstetrician said, I've got a really good feeling about this. And I said, look, I've been through hell. Sort of told him in brief what had happened, and I said, we've had so many losses along the way, and he said, no, I've got a really good feeling about this. I said, okay. So he did the transfer, and then we stayed in Cyprus for about 5 days, and I hung upside down like a fruit bat on a sunbed and didn't move. And then came back, and they said, do the pregnancy test in 10 days. And I just felt it was different this time, which would be the third time, because we had 2 failed attempts. And it was. So I did the embryo, the pregnancy test, and it was positive. From then on, it was just like a normal pregnancy, really. I found an amazing obstetrician to deliver the baby, because I was worried about safety, because I was 54. And I had a cesarean, and it was a normal birth, and everything since then has been totally, completely normal. And he's had a very normal upbringing, and I think he's well balanced, and he's accepted. And I'm accepted among all his friends and his friends' mums. And it's just like normal. I just feel like a normal person again.
So it must have felt like somebody was smiling down on you, yeah, after all that, yeah, long period of loss.
Yeah, because I've been told by some various mediums that there's a baby coming to you and it's a boy, and it's a gift from your daughter. So, and it wasn't just one person who told me that. There were various people who told me that. And and I honestly believe that it was a gift from Rosie. He was a gift from Rosie, and he's great. You know, he's just a normal teenager, stroppy sometimes, and you know, but no, he's lovely. I found from having another baby, it kind of gave me back a future. It was never a replacement for Rosie, and I've always said that. But it was a way of staying in the present, and giving my other daughter another sibling. Although at that time she was horrified at the thought of it, because she was only a teenager at the time, and she thought it was a terrible idea, and she was going, oh, you're far too old, mummy. But you know, the minute he was born, you know, they just absolutely loved each other, and they still do, so that's really nice. And yeah, I've got two grandchildren now, a grandson and a granddaughter, and see them lots. And yeah, it's okay. Life goes on. So after Dominic had been born, and that's all great, and it's all going along really well. And then my brother got very sick. We've been very close, and he was diagnosed with a brain tumour, and he had a sort of 5-year fight with this horrendous brain tumour, and eventually lost his life. He wasn't even old, he was my younger brother. And he found it very useful to be with me, and I was sort of showing him all about my spiritual beliefs, and I'm a bit addicted to psychic stuff and, yeah, sort of kind of spooky stuff, people call it. So we used to go to spiritualist church together, and he used to see some mediums, and they would bring evidence of life after death, and that absolutely it's not the end. And so he was very comforted by that, knowing that it wasn't going to be the end. He was only really scared of the actual dying bit, not the actual... He was scared of the pain of the actual process, but he wasn't scared of what came after. And we used to have long, long conversations about it. And I think that was immensely helpful for him, but we really miss him. Yeah. And then recently my mum died. She passed away. She was 93. But she'd seen, you know, the death of her granddaughter, the death of her son, having to cope with me. And also I had cancer in between times as well, which I'd forgotten to talk about. So back in 2016, I found this lump, and it turned out to be breast cancer. So I had a year out of anything, really, just dealing with that and having a mastectomy. So that was another loss, because I lost part of me. And then mastectomy, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, the whole shebang. I'm fine now. So there's been an awful lot going on. So my mum had to deal with all that. And then she died when she was 93. Last September, I went into the house and found her, which was really not easy. So we're still dealing with that, really, and I'm still really feeling that. But it's a very different loss, losing a mum, and it's kind of in the right order. But we do, we really miss her, because she was absolutely like the matriarch of our family. And someone said to me a couple of weeks ago, she said, they said, oh, you're the matriarch now, because I'm the eldest in my whole extended family. And I went, I don't want to be that. I just don't want to be that at all, because that's not me. But my mum had always been absolutely like the rock. So we're kind of dealing with that and all the estate and all of what comes after your mum dies, really. So it's kind of difficult, but it's not like losing a child.
But what you haven't mentioned is the separation from your husband.
That oh, yeah, then not that loss. That yeah, a, that yes. loss, yeah. Yeah, so I won't go into details, but basically, fundamentally, I think there are so many couples that don't make it together after the loss of a child. There's quite a high percentage of divorce. Because, I do know people who've made it through, who stayed together, but I think they've had a really strong marriage before. And I think we were just incompatible before, and even more incompatible afterwards. And we couldn't share the grief. So, so it's like you can't lean on someone who's broken themselves. And he was very broken, but handled it in a very different way. So we just kind of really grew apart. And then the final divorce actually came through when I was actually on the operating table, just about to have my mastectomy, and the decree absolute came through on that morning. So that was that ending, and then there was the ending of the operation. So it was a lot to contend with, but we get on okay now, strangely. He's a great dad to Dominic and to Ellie, my daughter. So we actually get on okay. So we're kind of good friends now, but yeah.
So I don't know how to put this without sounding glib, and I do not want to sound glib at all, but you are kind of like the expert in loss, aren't you, really? And I'm wondering if you've got any advice to pass on to other people who've been through major losses like you about how you've managed to come through.
My advice, well, I'm not an expert. I've just kind of lived it, that's all. And that, I had to survive. Well, it's either survive or don't survive. So you either you either don't make it or you do. And I just found by keeping busy and keeping distracted, that was an enormous help for me. By talking to people and talking and talking and talking with people who wanted to listen, and they didn't all, but people who wanted to listen, that was really helpful. And just channeling my darkest grief into something positive, because that really did get me out of a hole, and still does, because I still have those moments, you know. But I just hang on to the fact that actually there is actually joy to be had. That's why I called my book The Future is Rosy, because I do feel that in spite of everything, there is still a rosy future to be had, even though you've been through like the darkest times. And I think that's not just for child loss, it's for any sort of loss. I think, you know, if you can just find a way through and just keep positive and keep busy, yeah, that's kind of worked for me.
Carolyn, it's been wonderful to meet you. Thank you so much for sharing all that. And just in case anybody wants to donate to your fabulous charity, it's called again?
It's called Rosie's Rainbow Fund. You can go on rosiesrainbowfund.co.uk. You can donate, or you can contact me. You can go through my author website, which is carolynmayling.com. If anyone wants to buy a book, they can buy it via my website, or from any bookshop they can order, or from Amazon. It's on Amazon as well.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Fabulous to meet you.
Thank you.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.